We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We will introduce our returning guest in a minute. But first, as always, wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Hopefully, a lot of you heard my interview with Micah Keatman. But by the time you hear this, the Chessable Create Your Own Course contest should be ongoing. So whether you are a professional or an amateur with a passion for chess, you should consider entering this contest, the chance to make a little money on the side and share some chess ideas. So I will link to that in the description. Also wanted to shout out one of their new courses, The Killer Barry Attack by Simon Williams and Richard Palliser. I was checking it out. It's like a hybrid between the London and the Jabava, I guess is how I would describe it. And after seeing so many Londons in the FIDE World Cup, maybe you need to move on to a new suddenly main line. So just a couple of the many things to check out from our friends at Chessable.com. As always, I will put a few relevant links in the description. Now, as for this week's guest, he is a return guest. I interviewed him, or our episode came out almost a year to the day from when I sit here with him on Zoom right now. He is a World Chess Hall of Fame inductee with a peak ranking in the top 20 in the world. He's won the World Open, the US Open, the Aeroflot Open, the 2021 U.S. senior champion. He's also a six-time chess Olympian who's coached the U.S. women's team. He's now a top trainer in the U.S. He's coached many of the U.S.'s top talents, but unlike a lot of players from his generation, still plays quite actively. In fact, he just returned from the FIDE World Cup, which we will be wrapping up in discussion and hearing his own personal reflections about how he played. He also recently played in the U.S. senior, and soon enough, he will be going on the road again, both for chess and for pleasure. And I am honored, as always, to welcome back to the program Grandmaster Gregory Kadanov. Welcome, Gregory.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Yes, such an honor to speak with you, and so much to talk about in the chess world, as always. But Gregory, I wanted to begin with the FIDE World Cup. We're starting to sort of put it in the rearview mirror. Obviously, I was watching your games. I was rooting for you. Didn't go the way we wanted, but nonetheless, at least from my perspective, an entertaining tournament. Before we get to your own tournament and trip report, Gregory, when you came back and started to get back into your routine, did you follow the tournament subsequently?
Yes, I followed the tournament. I didn't look like, at every game. As I mentioned during our last meeting, I don't like to look at the games in progress because I would like to save them for solitaire chess later on. But I did follow the tournament, and I did look at a bunch of games anyway.
Okay, and as it gets later in the tournament and as the suspense mounts, especially as we move towards tie breaks and some of the critical matches, do you then ever sort of break your rule and tune in?
I don't have problems watching fast games. I don't have problems watching openings. But most of the time, I don't like to watch the whole game in progress.
Yeah, makes sense. And so have you reviewed many of the games? So for listeners who did not hear our prior interview, it is episode 294, highly recommend it. Gregory, of course, is a legend of the game, tells some great stories, and is also obviously a top trainer. So lots of good chess improvement reflections as well. And in that interview, Gregory talked about his affinity for what we call solitaire chess, or you might call it guess the move, where you actively review games by playing through it and only revealing what was played by the other side in a game one move by one. And he, to this day, has been doing it for decades, but still studies that way. So did you look at a lot of the games from the World Cup, Gregory?
I looked at, I think, majority of games from 2 and 3s. I mean, 1, 2, 3 rounds. So, but not after that.
Is it because you haven't gotten around to the later ones, or what was the reasoning that you stopped there?
Just I'm kind of moving towards. So I just had time to do this 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
So I'm going to study 4, 5, and subsequent.
That's fun, but you have read the articles, obviously, and are aware of who got candidate spots.
No. I follow, you know, every single game. I just don't see the moves. I don't play through the moves.
That's okay. And what was your, like, what was your overall impression of the match from a sort of more an analyst perspective? Was there anyone whose play particularly stood out to you?
Of course, you know, the winners, they deserve it fully, you know. So, I mean, World Cup is obviously a very special tournament, right? We don't have anything like that in chess. And it's a tournament where you cannot have a lucky winner. So almost always the winner deserves it. Though, in the past, there were cases when I think Timur Rajabov was one example when he was trying to draw his main classical games and then try to win in rapid chess. So there were things like this. But two guys who won, who met in the final of this tournament, they Carlsen and Pregnano, but they both had a fantastic tournament and they played great chess in the process.
And were you surprised at all by, I mean, obviously Magnus is kind of the least surprising thing, despite the fact he hadn't won the World Cup previously, but were you surprised by Pragananda, by his performance?
Not at all. No, not at all. You, obviously, this tournament is the tournament for guys like Gukesh, Pragananda, and Nedere Gassi. This is the tournament made for them, because they are already great players. They're young. They, you know, their stamina is great. They all good in rapid chess. So when you kind of put it all together, you know, this is a great tournament for them.
Yeah, Fabiano, you could see how tired he was in his interviews, and he mentioned in interviews how tired he is. And obviously, Fabiano's a fit guy, and you know, vastly experienced. So for someone like him to really be feeling the effects does sort of underscore what you're saying about the advantage of youth.
It's interesting. I didn't see any Fabiano's interview, but I figured out that he was tired by the blunder he made in the match against Abbasov, in the first game against Abbasov. But so I figured out he must be tired if he made such a blunder. But I didn't see the interviews.
Yeah. And what did you think of Abbasov's performance?
It's incredible. It's incredible. But again, this is what we love World Cup for, because almost every World Cup, we see someone emerging from nowhere. I remember, you know, several successful stories. I remember first time hearing about Nisi Peanu, the Romanian and turned out to be German grandmaster when he was a young player, and you know, nobody expected him, and he did very well. Wesley So. It's kind of funny because I think Wesley So maybe was 15 year old at the time when he had a successful run in World Cup, and everybody was talking about him. And I remember an interview by Boris Gelfand, and he was very annoyed. He said, I don't appreciate, you know, that there is so much noise about Wesley So. I think me and Ivanchuk understand chess no worse than him, and, you know, we should be. And it's kind of, you know, interesting that now all those three players are now still talked about after so many years. But World Cup was the first tournament when lots of chess fans heard the name of Wesley So.
Yeah. It's
But going back to Abbasov, the Azeri player who made such a huge wave. So, again, you know, fully deserved and pleasant surprise of the tournament. So.
Yeah. And he's 28. It's funny where when he first started to make a deep run, I wasn't as familiar with him as I am a lot of other players. So look up his Wikipedia page and, you know, not knowing his full background, you know, off the top of my head, I just assumed he couldn't be older than 23, you know,
right.
and then you see he's 28 and it's like he's over the hill almost, except he isn't, obviously.
Right. Since we touch on this subject, I would like to mention something, and probably majority of our listeners are not aware of that, and but I would like to mention this anyway. So in some Russian-speaking media, I don't know whether you are aware of this or not, there was a mention of supposed cheating accident which involved Abbasov when he was like a 9 or 10 year old boy, okay, and therefore, you know, people were kind of trying to cast a shadow on his accomplishment and saying, you know, if he was accused of cheating when he was 9, 10 years old, maybe, you know, his result had something to do with this. And of course, I would like to say that I don't believe in this categorically. I'm 100% sure it has nothing to do with this. There was no cheating in the World Cup, but we live in reality when almost whenever somebody shows a good result, you know, there will be some accusation of cheating and of suspicions. But
I'm glad you mentioned that. And I had read that report. It did make its way in English to Chess Reddit. So luckily, I didn't have to use my terrible Russian to read that story. And listeners can find a little more information, some of it probably half-baked. But you can read about the case if you attempt to. And since you mentioned it, Gregory, one other thing I did want to mention, and this also sort of falls in the category of, say, innuendo. So caveat emptor, and these are just allegations that I'm stating. But around the time of the Hans Niemann controversy, there was a list published of what basically chess.com in some of their correspondence provided information about players who had been banned online without necessarily saying their names. And then some Reddit detectives went and sort of back solved for who it could be under the circumstances. And Abbasov's name was also on that for possibly cheating online. So I know that raised a few eyebrows, particularly because like Magnus refused to play Niemann and now Magnus ends up playing Abbasov and doesn't say anything. Obviously, the cases are not identical. And there are many other names on the list with Abbasov. So I don't think that he should be treated any differently, either positively or negatively. And I don't even know for sure that the information is accurate. But what you're saying about the speculation about cheating generally at the World Cup. I think that also may have fed into the speculation, but I agree with you. He, in his interviews, he seemed extremely charming and modest, and you know, there's nothing suspicious in his games. But since you mentioned it, I didn't want to ignore that story also. Had you seen that list, Gregory?
No. I can't see this list, but I have to say that I have, you know, I mean, obviously cheating is unacceptable, and you know, I understand people's outrage, but somehow I kind of, you know, I'm trying to give it slack to young people, let's put it this way. So for a young person to resist the temptation to cheat online is very difficult. I kind of understand it. So yeah, it doesn't mean that I'm saying, you know, we should not punish those people or, you know, just let it slide. But I think people should be more forgiven. So, yes, you know, it's like, you know, you committed a crime, quote unquote, because obviously, you know, it's not like a real crime in real life, right? So it's, let's call it misdemeanor, right?
Right.
So, but, you know, young people, you know, young people do sometimes it's hard when you are young, so many temptations, so many things which can go wrong. So let's forgive it and move on. Especially if you get punished, you know, you serve your punishment. Let's just move on.
Yeah, well said. And yeah, this is something when I interviewed Grandmaster Jakub Agar during the cheating scandal, he also felt that there was a distinction between cheating online. It's so easy to do. We're not justifying it, but it's not the same thing as, in my opinion, as cheating in person. But obviously, the less cheating overall we have, the better. And that did connect with, I know a few people were surprised. And again, I didn't see any evidence of impropriety. The games seem legitimate to me. But nonetheless, I was surprised that FIDE didn't use a broadcast delay after all that has happened in the past 2 years. Did that surprise you as a participant, Gregory?
I have to say that when I was there, there was a delay. So, I can tell you, I would finish my game, get into my room, right? Get on the broadcast, and I see the positions which were, when I was in the tournament hall a few minutes ago.
Okay.
So, my impression was the game, you know, at least when I was there, there was a delay in broadcast for sure.
Okay, because I think it was Maxime Vachier-Lagrave had tweeted that there was no delay, and I think that led to that being kind of the prevailing wisdom.
I can tell. Maybe it happened later. I don't know, because I was eliminated after the first round. But when I was playing, you know, in the first round, I can tell you 100% that, you know, we played in the same hotel where I was staying, and when I would get to my room, you know, the games were, you know, broadcasted with a delay.
Okay. Well, that's reassuring. Yeah, just to clarify, what MVL tweeted was on July 30th, he wrote, just read in the regulations for FIDE Chess World Cup that there will be no broadcast delay in the game's transmission. I thought the delay was helpful to the reputation of the game, was quite easy to implement and had minimal drawbacks, would be happy if I'm proven wrong. So maybe that actually led to a slight delay.
Right. There was a delay. And you know, it was at least 15 minutes, maybe more. But definitely delay. And the security was very good. So, you know, I felt it was very safe from cheating.
Okay, good. That's reassuring. Yeah. And overall, my perspective was a very well run and entertaining event. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on this because merely talking about it gives it credence that, you know, based on what we've seen, it doesn't necessarily deserve. So, So let's bring it back to the chess. So I don't know if you saw Magnus's post-game interview after he won the World Cup, but he said something interesting about generations that I hadn't thought about. He said, chess is in good hands for the future. I think this generation of players born 1990 to 1994, and in that generation, as an aside, there's Fabiano from 92, Ding from 92, Nepo from 90, Giri 94, So 93, and of course, Magnus himself. So he said, I think that generation really have dominated for a long time. And finally, now with these youngsters born 2003 plus, we have a generation that's worthy of succeeding us. And when the time comes, and that time could be fairly soon. I found this distinction interesting because you do hear about Magnus's generation, his birth year in particular. Obviously, there's those like famous pictures of Howell and Nepo and Magnus when they're young. But I hadn't thought of it in like these 5-year clusters before. Had you noticed that this particular, especially the younger generation that he alludes to, had you noticed how closely clustered they are in terms of birth years, Gregory?
Yes. And I think it happens throughout the history from time to time that, you know, there are kind of, you know, lost generations. And, you know, sometimes it has something to do with, like, for example, you know, Karpov dominated, right? All players of his generation. And, you know, there were so many talented players, you know, and they didn't have a chance just because he was so dominant. And then the same thing happened with Kasparov. And Carlsen. This is, as a chess fan, it's fantastic time to watch those guys. I was going to say Indian, but not only Indian, because there is Abdus Satorov and there are others. So it's a lot of pleasure. It's a lot of pleasure, a lot of fun to watch them and to see them playing. So it's great.
Yeah. And of course, they can push each other. And perhaps in isolation, one of them may not go as far as the fact that they're all right there. And the players I think Magnus was fine was most probably had in mind based on birth year, as you say, Firouzja 2003, Abdusatrov 2004, Prague 2005, Gukesh, I forgot to copy the year, Irigesi 2003, Keimer 2004, and Sarin 2004. So just an incredible array of talent born within a few years. So I always ask this question, and I feel like it's kind of silly because it changes so quickly, as evidenced by Prague's recent dominance, you know, when before Gukesh had his period. But is there one above the others that, and of course, Firouzja is always there, just not playing as much, but is there one above the others who stands out to you, Gregory?
I love all of them. I love the watching their games. You know, everyone has their own style, though, of course, now it's not like it used to be. Obviously, engine kind of, you know, the styles are very similar now. We don't have Botvinnik and Tal, right? Or right. Karpov and Kasparov nowadays. But still, they do have their own styles, and to watch them playing is a lot of pleasure. And I think it will change after every tournament. So, yeah, Prague had a fantastic World Cup. And so right now it seems like he's, you know, emerging as a leader. But, you know, next tournament, everything could be different. So, of course, Gukesh's run was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So they all are great players. And Abdusatorov's performance was disappointing. He lost basically his first match against the Turkish Grandmaster Sanal. And it's kind of funny that it all happened in a second classical game, thanks to the most innocent move, en passant. You see, so he sacrificed a pawn, played e5 takes f6 to open the position of Black King, who was on the e-file, and in turn, a winning position to equal one, and maybe even slightly worse. So, So it's a disappointment, but he will be back. There is no question about it.
Yeah, for sure. I know I and many others tapped him in particular as someone who might make a deep run. And yeah, but someone, you know, someone's always going to fall by the wayside. And yeah, hearing you discuss that generation, I don't know if you got to see any of the Prague Iragacy tiebreak live, but
I did. I was watching this live, and it was incredible. It was incredible.
Yeah, the intensity and the focus. They just want it so bad, you know. Like
you see the dramatic twist with Prague being late for the
right. Yeah, just amazing. And then he wins that. And that's the decisive game. Yeah, and right. And of course the sideline that they're friends and they're able to compete so fiercely, and then spend time together that very day is a lot different than your generation, right? I'm sure you had your share of friends, but Kasparov and Karpov probably weren't going for walks every night.
Right.
So Gregory, let's finally get to your own tournament. Again, we wanted you to last longer. Speaking of young players, your opponent, Kartik Venkataram, 24 years old, from, you know, my perspective, put on an impressive showing. And then he gave Hikaru all that he could handle in the subsequent rounds. What was your mindset going in, preparing, and then how did you feel about how things turned out?
Unfortunately, things went wrong, first of all, with scheduling. Okay, so the U.S. Senior Championship ended on the July 26th. And the very next day, I have already to fly to Baku. All right, so I flew to Baku on 27, and I think the first round was on the 30th, I believe. So there was not really too much time to adjust. First of all, there was no time to prepare because the pairings came out either during U.S. Senior or maybe just a few days before U.S. Senior. So not much time to prepare, not too much time to adjust. I had a huge jet lag in the course of my stay in Baku. So I was so tired that basically in the second game, I already decided to go in. I didn't want to play rapid tiebreak. And I played, you know, I played too aggressively, but still it would be okay. Just again, one move. I played d takes e5. Missed knight g4, and after this it was all over. So but I was very happy with the first game. I was thrilled the way I played, because I found myself again in the position which I didn't remember very well. I remember it was a game Chipperin of Gelfand. I remember Gelfand lost. I knew that there was improvement somewhere, but I couldn't remember, so I had to make it up, and I found very interesting pawn sacrifice during the game, and very often it happens. You play like a sacrifice, right? But you are not sure what's coming from this sacrifice, right? So obviously you hope for the best, but during the game I was not 100% sure that it's going to work for me. But then, after looking at the game with the computer, it was perfect. It was a perfect game. So I was really, really happy to draw this game with black. And then just, you know, didn't play well the second game with white. But again, the credit goes to my opponent because he played really well, really well. And he's a strong grandmaster. So there is no shame. There is no shame in losing this game.
Yeah, yeah, he certainly acquitted himself well. But yeah, was disappointed as a fan of yours, nonetheless. So when you prepare for, or when you're trying to think of a game like that, there have been different schools of thought. Like, I can't remember who it was who I interviewed. I believe it might have been Hari Krishna, but one strong player gave the advice that if you're trying to think of something, but you're not sure exactly what it is, you just have to pretend you know nothing. Like, sort of like the chess version of like a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. whereas other people will try to sort of piece together, like, I know there's this idea, but I'm not sure exactly where. So if you're in a sort of opening structure where you're not certain what to do, but you have some ideas rattling around, how do you approach it?
Exactly like you described. I didn't know Hare Krishna said that. I thought I said that.
That could be. It could be. I wouldn't be the first time I misappropriated, but go on.
No. I'm sure you're right. But I was telling this, you know, all my students all the time. And I created this concept during the game against Peter Heine Nielsen in 2002 Olympiad. So I found myself playing Peter Heine on the black side of the Queen's Gambit, and he was working with Anand at the time, right? And he very quickly blitzed a bunch of moves, which I knew happened in the game, maybe Anand Kramnik, if I'm not mistaken. And I knew that I'm in his preparation. The game ended as a draw. I'm black, so I don't mind a draw, right? But I knew that since Peter Heine is in Anand's team, there is an improvement waiting for me somewhere, right?
Right.
So I just had to tell myself, okay, treat this as I see the position for the first time. I found the move over the board, which I knew was not the move Kramnik played, but I did it deliberately, and it worked great, though. You know, maybe objectively it was, from computer's point of view, it was not the best move, but I won a game, I think, you know, before move 30. So I was really, really happy. And then I formulated this principle, which you said, that when you are not sure, just treat it like you see it for the first time, try to forget everything and just play like you know nothing.
Yeah, there have been a couple times in my games I've wished I followed that advice, because you think this is the move, but you don't really think it through, and then everything.
Yeah, and that's what I did in this game, in the first game which I played, like I described to you, right? So, yeah, I couldn't remember Chipperian of Gelfand game, and then, okay, you're just on your own. So try to treat it like you see it for the first time.
Yeah. And what were the conditions like, Gregory? Were you pleased? I mean, I know, again, shorter stay than we would have liked, but were you pleased with the hotel and the organization of the tournament?
Yes. The conditions were good. So everything good. There were like some hiccups with food, but, you know, they were very mild. And so, and I think they fixed it very quickly. So the conditions were top notch.
And did you head straight home after the match?
No, I think I stayed a few more days. Just because, you see, I have a lot of lessons, so I should, I always, when I travel, I want to make sure that I travel on days when I don't have too many lessons. So I think I stayed through the second round and departed when the third round started.
Okay, but other than that, you're keeping your work schedule even when you travel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't give lessons during the tournaments, obviously. When I travel, I give lessons all the time.
More from GM Gregory Kaidanov when we come back.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. Prior to that, as you mentioned, you had the U.S. Senior closed. How was that tournament for you?
This was a very disappointing tournament. This tournament is, I consider this the main tournament of the year. So as soon as the tournament ends, I start thinking about next year. And I think about this, you know, the whole year. I think how I'm going to prepare for this tournament, you know, which openings I'm going to play, how I'm going to approach that. How can I learn lessons from the previous tournament? But the tournament was a disappointment. So I had a very good run. I had three good tournaments on the run to U.S. Senior. But what can you do? It's, you know, in my long life of chess professional, I learned one rule, that it's very hard to predict how you're going to do despite your preparation. Sometimes you prepare very well, you feel good going into the tournament, and you don't do well. And there are other times when you feel like you're going to do badly and you do well. So, I started perfectly. I started 2 out of 2 beating Patrick Wolf and Alex Shabalov. As it often happens to me, I already had a grandiose plan of
working on your acceptance speech.
Yeah. And then I lost the third round to Vladimir Akopin from completely equal end game. Just a collapse. And I did win a single game after that. So, yeah, it was very, very disappointing.
Yeah, I got the. So I interviewed Melek Kachin, obviously, who had a great tournament and won it. And congrats again to Melek. And I also got the impression, even though he didn't even know going in if he was going to be invited, but he started physical training and chess preparation 6 months in advance. And he described that tournament as a motivator, even though he didn't know for sure that he would be able to play. So I'm curious, Gregory, players of your stature and your generation, what is it about that tournament? Is it just because it's U.S. championship, or is it because it's all your old buddies? What is it that makes that tournament stand out above all the others for you?
That's only round robin tournament, which basically I play nowadays. You see, so which means you can prepare for every game in advance. And when I say in advance, you know, like at the beginning of the tournament, you know the colors and so forth. So, you know, the game starts at maybe 1 p.m. or so. So the previous evening, you already can start preparing, right? Plus, you know, it's a strong tournament, one round a day. So it's in great conditions, huge prize fund. So when you put it all together, you know, it becomes a very important tournament.
Yeah, makes sense. And Melek described some fun dynamics in terms of trying to predict the openings and then what ended up happening over the board in those games. So I was curious, like, how your preparation went. Did you feel like you were often getting the positions you expected?
My opening preparation in general is the best part of my game. Okay, so I was almost always getting positions I liked. Okay, so rarely, I never like caught my opponents in preparations, right? So, like, you know, I never, you know, achieved like winning position after the opening or humongous advantage after the opening. But almost always things went my way. in the opening. But unfortunately, you know, it didn't help much. I mean, I didn't win against Joel Benjamin, the game I should have won. Didn't draw a game against with Black, which I lost in two rounds before the end. So didn't help. The opening didn't help.
Gotcha. And so, but as you mentioned, you played some tournaments also in the preceding year, did particularly well in the El Abregat Open in Spain. Do you feel anything different when things go well as opposed to poorly, or do you just play the moves and see what ends up happening?
You mean during the tournament? That's what you mean?
Yeah.
No, I can't stay. I can't say that, you know, I belong to the category of players who are not impacted by how I play in the tournament. I do. Mm-hmm. So it's inevitably, you know, it impacts my play. So I don't play well after losing a game. I don't play well when the tournament doesn't go my way. So maybe I don't collapse. Okay, I'm not playing terribly, but I do play worse when the tournament doesn't go well, and also even when I play really well and I, you know, I have lots of points, sometimes I get too excited, and it also manifests itself in mistakes. So those things happen.
Okay, and you mentioned you try to extract lessons from the U.S. Senior Closed in particular. So, have you had a chance to extract any from this most recent tournament yet, or is that still to be determined? When you,
I'm still working. I'm trying to do different things. I dedicate some time to studying my games, and sometimes to solitaire chess, sometimes to openings, and sometimes to solving puzzles, right? And it kind of slows it down. So I still didn't analyze all my games from U.S. Senior. But one thing it's clear, it's very clear that there is a moment in the game where I basically collapse. So I play a good game to a certain point, not a perfect game, but, you know, I make maybe mistakes here and there, but they're not mistakes would determine the outcome of the game. But then the moment comes when I just completely collapse and make either one blunder or a series of mistakes, and you know, and obviously to fix it is not easy, you know. So nobody came up with a recipe of you know, the cocktail of youth. So
yeah, but, I was gonna say I can certainly relate to that. Sense, I'm sure it's frustrating for you, but I'm sure it's reassuring for me, and I'm sure all the other amateurs listening, that even at your level, you know, sometimes things just don't go your way, you know.
Right. But I still think about this, and it should be a way at least to when you are aware of things, that's already a big help.
Right.
If you know, when you know, okay, that's a moment when I feel like I'm getting tired and I might collapse. And so it's the same thing as, you know, like, you know, runner getting out of breath. You know this is happening. And when you are prepared, you know what you're supposed to do in those situations. Sometimes you get a second wind. So hopefully it might help in some moment, and it doesn't happen every tournament. So it did happen in U.S. Senior, but like I said, you know, I had three successful tournaments before that, so you know, it doesn't happen always.
Okay, and since we're on the topic of the U.S. Senior, I actually wanted to issue a minor correction. In my interview with Melik Kachin, I was discussing with him, Alex Fishbein had made a post highlighting that the more active players seem to do much better than the players who aren't playing as actively but still turn up for the U.S. Senior closed. And Alexei Root pointed out to me that I had made a mistake in characterizing Dmitry Gurevich as inactive, because he's actually been playing quite actively. So did want to correct that. But Gregory, I mean, it seems to me self-evident that it would be obviously, I mean, obviously we're busy. We have to make decisions about what we do with our time. I understand not playing, but is your staying so active? Are you partially motivated by the annual, knowing you're going to have the U.S. senior each year to try to put another trophy on the mantle and, you know, prepare properly against your old peers and win a bit of money, et cetera?
First of all, I have to say that, you know, I'm not that active in the sense that, you know, I play maybe, between 30 and 40 games a year. I wouldn't call it, you know, like super active, right? Definitely not like Alex Shabalov, who is probably the most active player among seniors. But I do keep I do keep U.S. senior in mind when I make my schedule. So I try to play a tournament before U.S. senior, but at the same time not too close, so that I have time to prepare.
Okay. And you mentioned before we were recording, you're heading to the World Team Championships shortly, correct?
Correct. I will have two tournaments in a row, which I don't like to play. But unfortunately, it just happened this way. So I enjoy playing World Team Senior every year. It's a great tournament. It's kind of, you know, basically reliving the Olympiads,
right?
I used to play, and of course I wanted to play Qatar a long time ago, and I wrote the letter right after they announced that Carlsen is going to play. I wrote the letter asking them whether, you know, they will accept me, and I didn't get response for a long time. So USF was incredibly slow and basically non-responsive in all our attempts to ask the question whether USCF will send a team. And just maybe, I don't know, a week ago or 10 days ago, both USCF said that they're going to send a team, and the Qatar sent a letter that, you know, that they're going to have tournaments.
Yeah, that's great news on both accounts.
Right. But the tournaments will be just like 10 days apart, so it will be very tough to play in Qatar for sure. Yeah. I don't like to play it.
That's like a big open tournament, right? With, I mean, obviously Magnus is in it, but many others.
But they don't have any information. You see, so they announced that Magnus is going to play, but I'm worrying, you know, that, you know, I will come and first of all, maybe Magnus will not play. And if Magnus will play, will be not that many strong players. I have no idea what's going on. They don't even know the venue. They don't say, we don't know where the tournament will take place.
Wow.
So yeah, they're very late with the details and with arrangements, but okay. Hopefully it will be a good tournament.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. And I always enjoyed, or have in the past, Joel Benjamin's write-ups of the World Senior Team, in Chess Life magazine. Do you know who your teammates will be this time?
Yes. So our team will be Vladimir Kopin, myself, Igor Novikov, Alex Shabalov, and Jan Elvis. So
okay.
That will be the team.
Yeah, really, like you say, just the all your old sparring partners, and I don't know if you want to call them rivals, but certainly competitors.
Right.
Well, I wish you luck as always. I'll be watching and rooting. Next topic I wanted to talk about, Gregory, as we record this on the August 30th, the news broke a couple days ago that chess.com and Hans Niemann have, I don't know if we can use the word amicable, but they've resolved their dispute. I'm going to read their statement just for clarity for anyone who didn't catch this news. So they wrote, "Dear chess community, we're pleased to report that we've reached an agreement with Hans Niemann to put our differences behind us and move forward together without further litigation. At this time, Hans has been fully reinstated to chess.com, and we look forward to his participation in our events. We would also like to reaffirm that we stand by the findings in our 2022 public report regarding Hans, including that we found no determinative evidence that he has cheated in any in-person games. We all love chess and appreciate all of the passionate fans and community members who allow us to do what we do. So I'm curious, we didn't talk much about the whole story last time, and now there's this new information. What's your overall impression of this longstanding issue, possibly at least getting put on the back burner?
Okay, I'm a big fan of Magnus Carlsen, right? So I think he's an incredible player. I think he's an incredible champion. I mean, used to be, right? So he did so much for the game. I love how he's critical to himself. I love how most of the time he's very respectful to his opponents. So I just like Magnus in general, right? But at the same time, he was 100% wrong in this whole controversy. So it was wrong on many different levels, and I have sympathy for Hans. Hans is obviously, you know, life is not easy for Hans. So, and yes, people call him arrogant, and, you know, he probably should have filed this lawsuit, but it was probably a frivolous lawsuit, but it's good that it's over. It's good that it's over, and it's good that, you know, everybody made peace. I don't think anybody wanted to see chess.com being heard. And like I said, I don't want Hans being hurt too. He proved to himself to be a strong player, and he proved to himself to be 100% dedicated to chess. I mean, what happened after this scandal, just, you know, he has to be applauded for, because he traveled world basically nonstop, playing chess all over the world. You know, I guess maybe that's what he needed to do to stay sane, because obviously the situation was very difficult for him.
Well said. And yeah, I agree on all fronts. I mean, I've obviously discussed this in the context of other interviews, but did just want to highlight, I'm glad that they took the high road in this case. It didn't seem likely to me based on the way the lawsuits were going. So, you know, Hans was streaming during Titled Tuesday yesterday. It seems like maybe there'll be more information forthcoming, because it does seem like in this very legalistic statement that I read, it seems like there's freedom for all of the parties involved to speak freely now. And because, like you, I'm a big Magnus fan overall, but didn't see any justification for his actions based on the information that was presented to the public. So, you know, if there's more information, like, sure, let's have it. But I haven't seen it. One question I did have for you, Gregory, is, in obviously, as you say, things have been very hard on Hans. I'm excited to see him no longer be blacklisted from tournaments. But I did see some criticism where people say, you know, he's been playing in these open tournaments and he's been playing at a 2600, 2650 level, not a 2700 level, which is obviously, you know, pretty fine degree of criticism. But how do you respond to that? Like, does it matter? Would all 2700s play at a 2650 level if they played the schedule that Hans is playing? Like, what do you think about those criticisms?
Yeah, obviously he's playing worse because he plays so much. He must be incredibly tired, and he he's playing tournaments which you know, where he plays lots of players who are below his level. So, you know, almost every tournament he plays, he's either number one seed or close to that. So he plays nonstop. Like, you know, I played a tournament with him in Spain in December, right? And he started his tour before that. And look, it's what 9 months, and he plays nonstop. I don't think he had a break for a month even. So of course his results are going to be worse. But he's incredibly strong player, and as soon as he will slow down, you know, just get settled, started working chess in a kind of a normal manner, he will be back to 2700. So I think it just had connection to his emotional condition. He just needed to play nonstop to get busy himself and to stay sane. I think that was the main reason.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, been discussed many times on this podcast how tournament chess in particular does provide this degree of escapism, you know.
Absolutely. I remember, you know, I had sometimes, you know, hard moments in life, and when I started playing chess, I actually would play better because I will channel into chess those bad feelings, because chess will help me to forget those things. So I think that's a case about chess.
Yeah. And have you had any or many personal interactions with Hans over the years?
No. I never spoke with him. I observed him because, you know, I played several tournaments alongside him. So I observed him, like we had U.S. senior and U.S. junior happening at the same time. So, but no, I never spoke to him directly.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing your perspective. And again, just want to just express as a chess fan that I'm glad that we can put this behind us. And you know, Hans, for flaws notwithstanding, and in absence of evidence, he cheated over the board, firm evidence that he deserves the same treatment as all other players. So I'm glad to see that he's getting that. When we come back, we will hear whether Grandmaster Kaidanov thinks that chess books are still necessary to improve at chess in 2023. We'll be right back.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. Okay, so Gregory, I wanted to talk some chess improvement. Obviously, can't let you on your way without picking your brain a little bit. And you were recently featured as the coach of the month by chess.com, and Colin Stepshinsky, sorry, Colin, if I said your name wrong, wrote an informative little article about you with some quotes from you. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is something that Jakob Allgaard also mentioned on a recent Chess Journeys interview, and I touch on it in my book, which is the sad but possibly inescapable fact that chess books are no longer necessary. So when did you, and this is, my audience obviously loves chess books, so this could be a bitter pill, but when did you concede this point mentally?
Emergence of chess content on the internet, when I reached this point where basically every aspect of the chess book could be replaced by something else. You see, we loved chess books growing up because there was nothing else. But now, what is on the internet which is not on the chess book? Everything, and then much more convenient form, right? So you study the openings with Chessable, you play through the games like solitaire chess, like I said in the previous broadcast, you know, instead of covering text of the paper with covering text of the game with a piece of paper with a hole in it, you know, right. Which I used to do for 20 something years, you just have chess base in the training mode. So just everything, like even books. I do use books, but even when I use books, I use them in the computer format. Like I love Forward Chess.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and I buy books on Forward Chess most of the time. So it's for some people who used to it, you know, it's kind of a sad thing to see, but we're a dying breed. So, the truth hurts. young generation, you know, very soon they will say, book, what is book?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no use hiding from that fact. And you gave another bit of what I consider to be helpful advice in this feature, where you say, when you study chess, try as much as possible to be in a solving mode. Doing puzzles or guessing moves from Grandmaster games is the best way to improve. Watching chess videos is not. So I especially enjoyed the last part, because you know, on the one hand, you're highlighting the fact that books aren't as necessary as they used to be, but you're not saying that just means sit back and watch YouTube. So, do you think videos can have a part as long as we're focused and pausing it, or do you just think that there are solving is better? Full stop.
Yeah. I mean, video is entertaining. Unless. You watch video, you have a chessboard in front of you, and like you pause video and there is a chess position, you think about chess position, you try to guess a move or something, you know, then there is a value. Otherwise, you know, it's just entertainment. So, but at the same time, you know, like for example, for young players, right, especially, and maybe for older players as well, your success is connected to your passion for the game. And if sometimes hearing an interview or watching a great player speak makes you more enthusiastic about the game, it's great. It's great. So obviously, the psychological side of chess is no less important, and in many cases more important than the pure chess part. So so maybe for many people, watching videos is good for their chess.
Yeah, and anything that keeps you interested.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right.
Okay. And Gregory, we have a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast. This is from David Hamm. Thanks for supporting the pod, David. He asks, what some good resources, exercises for adult improvers who are trying to grow as a chess player from a mental perspective? So he's looking to change the way he thinks, not just improve his technical skills. So I don't know if you have any non-chess book recommendations or like tournament routines that you recommend to your students. I'm not sure. Precisely what David's looking for, but any non-chess advice for chess players?
Okay. So I would say, you know, I would suggest listeners listen to your podcast, because...
Thank you.
No, but seriously, like 2 days ago, I was listening to the discussion about Jonathan Rowson's books on your podcast, and it was great discussion and very thought provoking about knowledge and skill, and you see, and things like that will help you to think about your game, about how you think. Obviously, analyzing your games and thinking about your games is maybe the most useful thing to do, because you need to think about your emotions during the game. How do those emotions affected your decision-making process? And then when you're away from the board, you start thinking, how can I improve this in the future? There are endless scenarios which we can discuss. But for example, you know, I just will give example one. I saw a winning move. I got excited. I played quickly to find out it was losing. Right. So obviously, the reason is okay. Whenever I see a move I think is winning, I have to be extra cautious because I have this experience already. So this is kind of one brick of the wall of knowledge, right? And you pick up a lot of those bricks from your own games, and you obviously build a wall of knowledge and psychological stability, which will help your game.
Yeah, that's a great insight, and it circles back to what you were saying about what you carry forward from, say, one U.S. senior closed to the next. And And hearing you discuss the knowledge versus skills dichotomy, you've done some work with adult students. Is that correct, Gregory?
Correct. I thought about the same issues. I never labeled them the way it was labeled in your discussion about the book, right? But those are things which I was constantly thinking about when I teach adults, which obviously is a challenge, right? Because to help someone improve in their 40s, 50s, 60s is a huge challenge. And majority of my students have certain patterns of mistakes, both over the board and outside the board, in terms of their understanding how they should improve. I have to do a lot of work to convince them that they need to do what they don't want to do.
Which is, does it get back to solving? Or
pretty much. But basically, yeah, because majority of older players, not all, but majority, rely too much on general things, and they feel like their understanding of the game should give them advantage over younger players and so forth. But the reality of life is that it does not. It does give you an advantage if your calculation skills are on the same level. But since they are not, we can see how, you know, the older generations, have very hard time to play with the kids.
Yeah, and it's very relatable. And David, when he sent me the question, and I think he's a newer player, is that he's rated below 1,000, but clearly working very hard on his game. He sent me a list of precepts that he'd copied from or made note of from Silman's, I believe it was Reassess Your Chess. But, and it's like 15 bullet points of all good chess advice, but it actually reinforced that very point to me where, you know, as adult learners, we want to know heuristics and, you know, we want to know facts. But at the end of the day, chess, competitive chess, it's a competition and it's like a big math problem, you know, each game and a, you know, decision-making contest in a sense. So those things tend to take primacy over the rules of thumb. But I certainly understand why players gravitate towards I do it myself. I'm not solving as I should be. And that's why I don't really expect, to make massive leaps in my chess ability, but it's a challenge. I don't even know, like, I don't even have a question, but it's just, I understand it from all angles, I'd say.
Yeah. I can talk forever about, how do you improve as adult. I just will mention one thing, which maybe users will find useful. So there are two types of calculation, forced calculation and unforced calculation. So when we solve problems on chess.com, leadchess, chesstempo.com, it's always, almost always forced calculation. We have a position, white to move, win. And so that's is very, very helpful. But when you play the game, most situations are not like that, right? Most situations are, let's say we're around move 16, 17, obviously, there is no forced win. We have no idea what's going on. Sometimes we don't even know who is better. And we have a choice between two, three moves, and we need to decide which move to play. So we need to calculate each one of those moves to a certain depth, sometimes maybe two moves deep, sometimes more, to compare the resulting position and then make a decision which move is better. And that's what I call unforced calculation. But that's a work which you do need to do. And unfortunately, most adults don't do that, and adult improvers, I should say, because it's hard, and they feel like they just don't need to do this. That at this point, the choice of the move should be based on general principles, and they try to kind of pile up those general principles on top of each other to decide which one is more important in order to choose a move. But that's not the right approach. You You have to go through this process, which I described, and doing solitaire chess is maybe the best way to do it. When you push yourself at home, instead of doing this over the board, and then over the board, of course, it should happen automatically if you do this a lot at home.
Yeah, that's a profound insight. That really helps crystallize a few things. The only thing I would say in response is, I, like a lot of the students that you mentioned, as I just said, like, I struggle to do calculation and hard work basically away from the board as an adult with limited time. But one thing I've observed from adults who have made good progress is that they play a ton competitively over the board, more, you know, 90% of the time. I'm just making that up, but that's my impression. And I think part of it might be that they may not practice it at home, but they play so much that the play is the practice.
Yes, absolutely right. I remember reading Nigel Short's comment, how he talked to this famous Russian grandmaster, Yuri Zavaev, one of the greatest thinkers in chess, and he asked him, like, you know, I have a hard time forcing myself to study. And Zavaev said, just play more.
Because
for many people, playing is a replacement for studying, but not for all and not always.
Right. So, yeah. And also, obviously, playing competitively presents its own budgetary and logistical challenges. So not trivial to be able to do that. Just a couple more topics, if you're okay with it, Gregory. There's always so much to discuss. When we come back, we will hear about Grandmaster Kaidanov's interactions with Grandmasters Naroditsky, Feingold, Shanklin, and Ulf Anderson. We'll be right back. And we are back. Colin, in his chess.com article, also highlighted some former students of yours, some of which we've either previously discussed or didn't surprise me. You discussed your relationship with Ray Robson in our prior interview. And we discussed a fascinating conversation about your work with Maurice Ashley in that interview. But I didn't know that you had worked with Naroditsky. Did you do much with Danya?
Yes, I work with Danya for maybe a couple of years or so. I already can't remember. But Danya always had other coaches as well. So, it was around the same time when I worked with Ray.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah. And are you surprised to see his success? I guess you could call it away from the board, certainly related to chess, but.
No, I'm really, really happy for him. He's a great person. I always enjoyed working with him. I have a lot of respect for everything he does. I kind of feel bad that he didn't yet accomplish everything his talent promised him to accomplish. Yeah, he deserves much more in terms of classical chess, right? But like you said, you know, he's successful in whatever he does. So, but I have a great sympathy for Danny.
Yeah. Yes. Great guy. And I didn't know you'd worked with Feingold either. Did you work much with him?
When Ben got Sanford's fellowship, I was his main coach, and we worked for a couple of years and became very good friends. I like Ben a lot. And we, you know, over the years, we met many, many times in the tournaments. And he stayed in my house. We played tennis. Ben is a very good tennis player, which many people probably will have a hard time to believe. But
what other chess players have you played tennis with?
Most of my peers, Shaba, Yermo, Elvis, so those guys.
And are you a tennis fan as well, like a professional tennis?
I used to follow it much more, less so now.
Okay.
But still, I do follow major tournaments. I don't watch it very often, but see highlights sometimes.
Yeah, same for me. And If I may ask you about one more student, that again, I didn't know you'd worked with Sam Shanklin.
Yeah, first with Sam, I worked for 1 year, once a week. So, it was a very successful year, and I think he appreciates it. Sam is one of the people who we say, you know, self-made man. So,
yeah.
He started late and he basically coached himself. I mean, obviously Jacob Ogard helped him a lot as well, but to reach the level he did, it's a lot of work. And Sam also is incredibly pragmatic as far as his work organized and how he approached his chess. Basically completely opposite to Daniel Naradin, right? Yeah. So, like, there are some people who do things which only can hurt their chess, and Sam does everything right, everything. So it helped him tremendously.
That's great to hear. What year, when did you work with him?
Somewhere when he was 15, 16 years old, around.
Okay. Wow. So still pretty young. And as he himself has said, not a standout by those standards at that age.
Right. Like he was on the same level as Dania around this time. And Dania is younger.
Yeah.
You see? So, but now many years later, you can see, you know, that Sam is higher than Dania. And a lot of this because of practicality. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. There's so much to learn from his work ethic and his dedication. So, I think my final question, I had the honor to interview Ulf Andersen in the past year, and I really appreciated that you sent a nice note and said that Ulf had really had an outsized impact on your development as a chess player. So I'd just love to hear more about that. What was it, just from doing solitaire chess, or what struck you about Ulf in your chess development?
His end game skills. But in general, I found his personality is almost like a mysterious, right? Because the way he played chess, he would play the same opening all the time. He played this Catalan line with queen a4 check. Get a dull position, make a draw in, let's say, 20 moves, and next game we'll repeat the same thing. We'll play three moves later and then agree for a draw again. You see, so it was just a complete mystery for me, why and how are you going to do that? And then I asked this question Yasser, because I knew Yasser knew, and I asked Yasser, like, yes, sir, tell me a little bit about Ulf, because I don't understand, you know, how does he do that? And Yasser told me a little bit about this, and then this interview gave me more insight. You see, when you said that, you know, he offers draw in bullet games sometimes, it was hilarious, you see. But again, you get insight into someone who loves chess tremendously, there is no question about it, but at the same time has such a fear of losing that he does those things, and that's the reason why he offers those draws. But of course, for me, I was under a huge influence of his endgame skills, and at some point I copied a lot of his games in the notebook, writing down maybe 30-40 of his games, long games, end games. And then study those games diligently to become better in the end game.
That's interesting. And I checked ChessBase. You've never played him, correct?
I did. We played a game in Olympiad.
Wow. How did my ChessBase?
I think it was 2000, Istanbul Olympiad. He played very unambitious system against Catalan. Which you always played for years, and I had time to prepare, though there were no computers at the time. And he just easily equalized, and I offered a draw because I was afraid to get worse.
Sort of an endgame.
Instantly agree. instantly. I was afraid, like, what if he doesn't agree? I'm going to suffer. But, you know.
Did you guys look at the game? Or?
We exchanged some remarks, maybe, but very brief.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have you, out of all your games, everyone that you've played, I mean, we discussed your famous win over Anand in our prior interview. Obviously, Anand wasn't world champion yet at that point. But did you ever have a pinch me moment in all of your games? Someone that you just couldn't believe you were sitting across from?
Karpov. Yeah, I was talking about this in the previous interview. Because, you know, I studied a lot of his games specifically, right?
Yeah.
And then just a few months later, I found myself facing him. And one more thing was with Tal, because I played Tal in the last round of the tournament where I needed an IM norm really badly. It was my third IM norm. And maybe second. At this time, two were enough, and I played enough games. And fortunately, I made a norm right before the last round. And so when I played him, I was just, you know, looking at his face, smiling.
Any post-mortem with Tal?
Yeah. And we had the post-mortem, right, which was interrupted by his girlfriend coming and saying, okay, we need to go.
Okay. That's amazing. I just hearing you talk now, Gregory, it struck me that your English is amazing for having come to the U.S. as an adult. Did you speak much English when you came here?
I spoke already a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
I learned language in school, and then of course traveling through Europe in my 20s helped a lot as well.
And do you speak any other languages?
No, just Russian and English. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Gregory, this has been amazing as always. Do you have anything else you'd like to discuss before we set you off on your travels in a couple days?
No, I will save it for future meetings. So
excellent. Sounds good. Well, wish you luck in Qatar and the world teams. And as always, really appreciate you sharing your stories and your insights.
Always a pleasure being on your podcast, Ben. I'm a big fan of yours and listening, you know, every week with a lot of pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. That's music to my ears. Really makes my day. So appreciate it. And we'll chat again sometime. Safe travels.
Thank you.
Podcast Network.